Play to Potential Podcast.
Welcome to the fourth conversation of the Play to Potential podcast series. This is Deepak Jayaraman here, the creator and curator of this series of conversations. I have a confession to make up front. I'm a big fan of stand-up as an art form, and I've always admired stand-up comedians for their razor-sharp intellect and wit, high levels of empathy to connect with the audiences, and superior communication and storytelling skills. With that theme in mind, my guest this time is Papa CJ. Papa CJ is a world-renowned stand-up comedian, and he's won awards for both Asia's and India's best stand-up comedian. Forbes magazine called him the global face of Indian stand-up. Papa CJ holds an MBA degree from University of Oxford and is a former management consultant. Interestingly enough, he's coached executives from over 50 blue-chip companies such as Google, UBS, Nike, Unilever, BBC, and Accenture, just to name a few. In our chat, we spoke about how he transitioned from the world of management consulting to being the stand-up comedian that he is today, and some of the lessons the corporate world could learn from the world of stand-up. Without further ado, over to the conversation. So CJ, thanks for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
It's my pleasure.
And I must say, a few weeks back, I caught your show Naked in Bombay. And I must confess, I've been to quite a few comedy performances, but this particular one left me in a very reflective mood. I must say, off the various shows I've done, that's not a word I would use at the end of a show like that. So give us a sense, for the purpose of listeners, a sense of what the show is about and how it came to being.
So are you trying to say that you watching another man naked left you reflective is what you're trying to say?
Let's just say it left me thinking about a lot of things in life.
No, so the thing with Naked is like, I almost don't call it a stand-up comedy show because it has so many different elements. It's got theater, it's got storytelling, it's got poetry, it's got a little bit of music and dance. But the essence behind the show is, as human beings, we kind of have brick walls that we build around ourselves, which hide our deepest hopes and fears and desires. Now, in the course of this show, one brick at a time, I remove these walls, exposing myself with all my vulnerabilities, all my pain. And it is terrifying and exhilarating at the same time, because by the end of it, while you are completely naked, you are also completely free. So that is the essence that lies beneath that show. And I think what really works for that show is when people watch that show, it's not, I'm using the vehicle of my life to talk about the trials and tribulations of the human experience. So every single person in that audience at some point has felt similar to what I felt or has gone through similar experiences. So when I'm performing, they don't feel like I'm telling the story of my life, but it's almost like I'm telling a story of their lives. And that's where the connection in that show is so strong.
That's interesting. Again, I must confess, you're right. Comedy is probably the wrong term to describe the show. It's clearly, it leaves you with a very, very different aftertaste, very different from what you would experience in a typical comedy show. So, and is there any context...
By the way, I just make sure your listeners know that the show is funny as well, right? It's not just some intense,
indeed.
Hardcore stuff.
But what's the genesis of this? Why did you do this?
You know what happens as an artist, as a performer, you go through different levels of growth. And when I say growth, I talk about personal internal growth. Because, I mean, there are some comedians who can perform the same 20 minutes for 20 years and have gone on to do that. Today, most corporate shows, whether it's in the country or abroad, I can do them in my sleep. But the second you start getting so comfortable, I think you start to stagnate. So for me, this was a show that helped me grow internally as a performer. I had to push myself beyond my comfort zone. And I think that's kind of where it came from. You've got to consistently ask yourself, what's next? How do I grow further? I mean, the same works for organizations and creativity and innovation. I think often organizations are scared to innovate because they don't want to be seen to be failing at things. But the question you have to ask yourself is, if I'm still doing exactly what I'm doing now, 10 years from now or 20 years from now, will I be competitive? Will I be well regarded? And if the answer is no, then you have to experiment, you have to create. And failure is a part of the creative process. You cannot succeed without failing. But if you don't fail, you will never succeed.
Actually, on that note, CJ, if you will, I want to rewind the clock.
Yeah.
You grew up in India. You went to Lawrence School, Sanawar. Went to Delhi University for your undergrad.
Yeah.
Then went to Oxford at a pretty young age.
Yeah.
And then you were working with a reputed consulting firm, like yes. a lot of us do, a lot of us did. And then a year or two later, stand-up happened.
Yes.
That's a non-trivial transition.
Yeah.
So let's just double-click on that. Tell us, walk us through how that passage of play happened.
That's a long passage of play you're asking me to walk you through. So see, I grew up in a very simple family. My father was a tea planter. He worked for one company for 35 years. Eventually went to the head office in Calcutta. Now, as a child of middle-class parents growing up, what do you do? I mean, we all have this mentality of beta settle ho jao, right? Nobody knows what settle actually means. I think the basic idea is you do school, you do college, you try and do a postgrad degree, you get married, you have two children, then you're settled, right? Never in the Indian way of thinking, is there ever a concept of a gap year, for example, or a, you know, why don't you go out and experiment and discover what it is that you love doing? So I followed the traditional path. I finished my schooling from Sanaa. I got into Delhi University. Post that, I took any job I could. I used to walk the streets of Calcutta trying to convince shops to stock Coca-Cola. Then for 6 months, I worked with Unilever. Now, the fact is, India is such a massive country with such a large population. It is so difficult to compete. I think today, if you want to be a waiter in a five-star hotel, you probably need a postgrad degree. So a BCom isn't enough. I did my the foundation exam for the CA for the Chartered Accountancy course. Yeah. I got an All India rank, wow. But it was just so dull. I mean, I wanted to stab myself. So the MBA was my way out. I remember studying for the GMAT, and I almost failed second year college. Because in the middle of the second day exams, there's a friend of mine who is school captain Sherwood. And we were in Delhi. I said, listen, let's go play golf. And he said, where should we go? I said, let's go to Simla. And he said, no, we can't go middle of the exams. I said, okay, let's toss a coin. So we tossed a coin. I won, went to Simla, came back. I failed two exams, got exact 40%, half a mark less than I would have to repeat second year college. And my friend, school captain Sherwood College, failed second year. So then in my third year, I gave half my papers from second year again. I studied for the GMAT. I worked really hard and somehow got on the Oxford MBA program. Even with the Oxford MBA program, I was going to be the youngest MBA ever because I was 22. And they gave me a deferred admission for 2 years later. And I kind of negotiated my way in because I had gotten to Manchester Business School and a few others at that point. And I called Oxford and said, listen, you want me, you got to take me now. So they literally called back 3 hours later and said, the admissions committee has met and we've decided to let you come in this year. So went to Oxford. Oxford was a tough year because I had to take a loan for my MBA program. My dad was a tea planter who started work at 825 rupees a month. I used to look at Starbucks coffee from outside and could not dream of going in because I could not imagine paying £2 for a cup of coffee. I did more job applications than my entire course put together. I interviewed with, you name it, whether it's a Goldman Sachs, a McKinsey, a L'Oreal, I interviewed with everybody. But most people didn't want to hire a 22-year-old MBA because I was an MBA, so I wasn't an undergrad, yet I didn't have that work experience. Somehow I landed a job with...
Actually, if I may pause here, CJ... At the point of admission, what stood out for them to admit a 21-year-old or a 22-year-old?
My GMAT scores were really high. And I think I was a generally sharp kid. And they must have seen something in the application. I have no clue, man. When you get into some place, you think it's easy. If you don't get in, you think, man, that's a tough place to get into. In fact, I remember I was applying to Harvard and Stanford as well. And you know how all these essays, they have similar questions. Where do you see yourself 5 years from now? Things like that. So I did a cut and paste job. And I sent my entire application to Harvard Business School, telling them how I really wanted to go to Stanford. They didn't even bother to reply with a rejection letter. Like, I remember thinking at that point, damn it, $125.
It might have gone to a different person.
Whatever happened, that was not cool.
Okay.
So yeah, that happened. Got into a consulting firm in London, started working there. Now, that consulting job for the first 3 years was, I went as a young kid who wanted to change the world. I wanted to learn, I wanted to work hard, I wanted to achieve. But for 3 years in that firm, I was completely wasted. I spent half my time on the bench. I had 6 different jobs. It was the kind of firm where you could get into different departments. It wasn't pure consulting. And this was the year 2000. So a lot of people were losing jobs. But purely because I was good with people, I kept getting employed in different parts of the company. Then eventually I figured out a way to get a sabbatical on 35% pay. In fact, I went to my boss and I said, listen, I want to take a year off. And he said, no, you can't take a year off. So I spoke to an HR partner who was a friend of mine. I figured out a deal where you could get 1 year off on 35% pay. Went to my boss, sold him the idea, and both of us left the company on a sabbatical.
Fascinating.
Now, that was the year when I tried lots of things. You know, I set up some schools for underprivileged kids. I learned how to fly paragliders. I trekked up to Mount Everest Base Camp. And that's when I went to the Edinburgh Festival. And I saw stand-up comedy for the first time. And I just thought, this is amazing. I mean, here's a guy on stage talking rubbish. He's got a drink in one hand, a microphone in the other hand. And he's just having fun. And that's his job. And I thought to myself, you know what, I'm going to try this. So 3 months later, I got up on stage, did 250 shows in my first 10 months, and didn't look back.
Wow. And let's talk about those 3 months for a minute, right? Again, 90 days is sort of the golden period for leaders to set into organizations or shift careers. But give us a sense of what those 90 days were like. How did you prepare for your first show?
I think I started watching a lot more comedy. And I joined they had a small stand-up comedy course in London. Now, what happened, I don't remember actually learning anything there. And I don't think the people on that course actually thought I had any potential. But what happened was you found a bunch of guys with whom you could both struggle together. So there were 10 of us who really wanted to be comedians, and we would go to the same open mic nights, and we would talk to each other and try and get shows together. So that camaraderie kind of helped build that platform from which to leap off.
And 250 shows in 10 months is like, it's about 25 shows a month, which is like a show a night roughly, right?
Yeah.
That's brutal.
You know, I was I was the hardest working comedian in the UK. And normally there's 500 comedians competing for the same gig. I was the kind of guy who would go anywhere, anytime for no money. And a lot of the shows were outside London. So, for example, I would leave London at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, drive to some city in the UK with a bunch of other comedians, do a show there. I was nervous, I wouldn't eat, probably couldn't afford food at that point. Drive back, get dropped off in the outskirts of London at 2 o'clock in the morning. I would pay the driver my share of petrol. I mean, keeping in mind, I wasn't getting paid for any of these shows. I would change 3 different buses to get back home and get home at about 4 o'clock in the morning. I did this every single day for an entire year. But at the end of that year, you have no money, no friends, no relationships, and no life. But every single comedy promoter in the country knows your name. That's where you start from. But the thing is that I think the beauty or why it worked was I actually had no idea how difficult it was or how low the probability of success was. So as they say, ignorance is bliss. So I just kept my head down and I kept going at it. But even after a year of doing that, I went completely broke. So I took up a job with a recruitment firm. I used to work in the day and perform at night. But I think an important thing to keep in mind is that in my head, you know, often they say, oh, okay, I'm going to do it as a hobby, you know, and I'll get a job. In my head, I may have been spending 8 hours at work and 10 minutes on stage, But in my head, I was doing stand-up comedy. And the job was on the side to support me until I could get to a point where I didn't need to do it anymore.
Back to this gap year, I'm curious about what gave you this conviction that stand-up comedy was your calling or sweet spot, as they call it. The reason I ask is often when people are confronted with such a situation, there's always a stop-loss point where you say, you know, enough tried, let's go back to the regular life. Did you have that point? Did you come close to that border?
Or? I think the upside is that what you call the regular life, I knew I never wanted to go back to that. So it's like having a fire under your backside and something else in front. Even if what's in front isn't motivating you as much, you know that what's behind is something you never want to go back to.
Hmm.
You know, there's that old saying which I've always believed that if you want to walk on water, you've got to get out of the boat. Too many of us sit in that boat and put our foot out and, you know, touch the water and then say, oh, I'll take a call. It doesn't work like that. Sometimes you've got to just jump out. I believe that if you love what you do, you get good at it. And if you get good at it, the money will come. The problem is in most artistic fields, that gap between loving it and the money coming is indefinite. And we don't know if it will ever come.
Great.
So that's the period you have to last out. For me, I was just passionate about stand-up comedy. I loved doing it. There was nothing I would rather be doing. And because I had managed to save up enough to get me through 2 years, I knew I could go that distance without having to fall back. Also, I had an extremely supportive environment. My parents completely supported me. Now, 10 years later, they tell me, listen, we thought you'd do it as a hobby and stop in 6 months, but you just kept going on. But at no point did they ever make me feel that maybe I should do something else. So that was invaluable.
And again, reflecting on this, one is sort of going to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and saying, you know what, I want to do this.
Yeah.
Which is often driven by excitement and awe. The other is living the life. Give us a sense of what were the few things that were unexpected once you started living the life of a stand-up comedian that you hadn't expected when you set out on that path.
You know, I'm not going to be able to give you a good answer to that because I find that I'm not the kind of guy who goes into situations with expectations. I find if you don't have expectations, you're never disappointed. Because the field was so new to me, it was a completely blank slate. I had no clue what I was getting into. But I just knew that I was excited and eager to discover whatever it might be. And I've always believed it, and you've seen that in the show Naked as well. You have to play the cards that you've been dealt. It's almost an addiction for me. I have the ability to find the positive in every situation. I will always look at the plus side and what can be made of the situation, then look at what didn't work. So I think that's an important part of who I am, is I'm perfectly comfortable with uncertainty, and I will somehow try and find the positive.
Mm-hmm. But maybe to reframe the question, CJ, let's say if I'm an individual who's at the cusp of getting into stand-up comedy,
yeah.
And I come up to you for advice and say, you know, I'm thinking of this. What should I be aware of? What am I walking into?
Thing I will say is don't do it because I don't need the competition. The second thing I will say is you have to have a really thick skin because as men, if you ever try to ask a girl out on a date, for example, we are very bad with rejection, right? In comedy, you get rejected all the time. See, keep in mind that in our profession, we get feedback every 15 seconds. If they're not laughing, you have to adapt instantly. If you don't have the ability to adapt instantly, there's nothing worse than trying to make people laugh and getting 5 minutes of silence. So on the way home, you have to ask yourself, if I'm in the same country with a similar audience of a similar background, what can I do differently so I don't look like a fool? So for us, failure is the only way to succeed. You have to put yourself in different situations. You have to keep failing. And that is what makes you grow. So if you're getting to do stand-up comedy, you have to know that it is a marathon. It is not a sprint. And you have to be prepared to constantly fail. I've been doing stand-up comedy for 12 years. I've done 2,000 shows in over 20 countries. Today, I feel I know far less about stand-up comedy than I felt 3 months after I started doing it. Because now I know how little I know. I mean, the more you do it, the more you realize how much more there is to learn.
Yep. And if you look at, like in any profession, there are, capabilities or must-haves for that profession. What do you think, if you had to decode the recipe of a good comedian, what are the 3-4 traits or characteristics that you would highlight?
I think the one thing that is really important is honesty. You have to be able to be honest with your audience, but more than anything else, you have to be able to be honest with yourself. What I find I admire the most in any comedian is authenticity. You see, we operate in a profession that has no rules, no boundaries, no guidelines, no social norms that say you can say this, you can't say this. So for the first time, you're thrown into a space where you have to ask yourself, what do I genuinely feel about these things without any social conditioning? And it is an incredible journey of self-discovery. I mean, my definition is, I call stand-up comedy an outward expression of an inward journey. So for me, authenticity is critical. If you are trying to be somebody else on stage, the audience will see through that. And also, finding your voice is a journey. You can't be this person right at the start. When you start performing, you're trying to please everyone. You want the confidence that you can make people laugh. Over the course of time, as you find your own voice, you're just being yourself. You're doing it. I mean, at this point, I'm doing it more for myself than for them. If you like it, fine. If you don't like it, also fine. You can leave. Eventually, your audience will find you. The people who don't like your kind of stuff will wean themselves out automatically. So authenticity, number one. Number two, vulnerability. An audience wants to see somebody they can relate to. In India, there's a misconception. People start thinking of stand-up comedy or comedians as celebrities. It is the antithesis of celebrity. Because as a celebrity, I can say, hey, you know what it's like when you're getting bored and you buy a car for $100,000? No, they don't know what it's like. But as a comedian, I can talk about a receding hairline. I can talk about a bad marriage. I can talk about failing at things. And my audience can relate to that. That is very important. One of the biggest compliments I ever got was from a woman who thought she was offending me. She said, if you don't mind, can I say something? I said, yeah, sure. She said, you are like us only. And I don't think she realized what a big compliment that was, because it's very important for your audience to be able to feel that you are one of them. That's what makes them go with you. So authenticity, vulnerability, and like I said, a really, really thick skin. You've got to be able to go the distance. And also, I think it's important to not to have something different to say, but to have a point of view that is unique to you. I never understood this when I was starting out, and it's still something that's difficult to do. But if all the jokes you did, or all the stories you told on stage, if somebody else picked up and was able to perform them, then it's probably not you, right? I never understood that when I was starting out. And it's something that's still difficult to do. But I can see how that would work with a show like Naked. Right? Nobody else can do that show. And I think that's important to have your own individual voice and your persona.
Fascinating. I think like in any creative profession, there's always the inside out versus the outside in, which is often market driven. So what I hear you say is, over the long term, the more and more you're inside out.
See, the outside also matters. I mean, you've still got to be professional. You've still got to be funny. You've still got to deliver. You've still got to pay the bills. You still have a brand that you have to build. Brand is really important. But 90% of most businesses is relationships and networks, right? And your personal brand. A lot of people can do the job. But the question is, who does that client want to work with? Right? It's in consulting, you have, the airport test, for example, yeah. Right? If you were to miss a flight and you were stuck in an airport for 6 hours with that person, could you sit with this person? Often it's that,
Yep. And you spoke about marathon versus a sprint, right? As you look at the people that have come into this profession in India, in the West.
Yeah.
And if you look at the people that fall off the hopper,
yeah,
over the short term,
yeah,
what are the failures? What are the reasons people don't stick the course?
I'm not sure I would call them failures. It's a very difficult course to stick. You know, stand-up is not easy to get good at. It is a tough thing to do, and you've got to constantly write material. You've got to constantly reinvent. It's not like it's an admin job. But I wouldn't call them failures. It's something you try, and maybe you find it's not for you.
Sure.
But there's something else for you. But I genuinely believe, as human beings, it is our duty to find something that we love doing, because the only way you can be the best at the in the world at something is if it's something that you love doing. Otherwise, you will never put in the kind of effort that is required to be brilliant at that. And I also believe that if you don't do what it is that you're meant to be doing, this is a bit philosophical, then not only are you depriving yourself of happiness, but you're also depriving the world of somebody who is meant to be a painter or a singer or a musician or whatever the case might be, because then you are not... It's all about delivering to your potential, right? There are too many people who are stuck in jobs because they have to pay the bills, and they're going there 9 to 5 hoping to find their potential and happiness outside that job. I understand you've got to feed the stomach and you have to feed the soul. You have to find a balance so that you can somehow finance feeding your soul. That is the Holy Grail.
And if you had to reflect on your journey and really say, what are the 2-3, let's say, tips you would give to people to play to their potential, right? Are there some underlying principles that stand out from your journey?
You know, one of the best pieces of advice I got when I was starting out was, it's very important for you to grow in the dark. Because the second you hit the limelight, you don't have the freedom to screw up. So I find it's nowadays people are too much in a hurry to get famous or to get rich or to get opportunities. But if you get an opportunity that is too big for you and you fail, it might be a while before people look at you again. So for me, what I love doing is going away back into the dark, experimenting, growing, trying to come up with something new, and then coming out to present that. I find nowadays people are trying to learn the tricks of the trade before they learn the trade. It's very important for you to focus on your trade. Find the passion, right? Get involved in it. Become good at it. Like today, for example, I have comedians who say, you know, what's the secret? How do I get ahead? I tell them, see, if you want to compete as an international comedian, you need 1 hour of bulletproof good material. Now, a new comedian does 5 minutes. I tell them, the second you've got 5 minutes that's brilliant, you don't have to go to every show and be brilliant for those 5 minutes. You take those 5 minutes and you stick them away in a bank. Then you create another 5, then another 5, until you've got that bulletproof 1 hour. Then you come out and announce yourself to the world. So similarly, with achieving your potential, you have to first focus on realizing that potential before you put yourself in a situation where somebody can push you down and you think, you know what, maybe I don't have what it takes, you know.
The other piece I want to talk about, CJ, is, again, reflecting on the show Naked. One of the pieces that stands out for me is the notion of vulnerability, right? And the role that it plays in building trust. Even in some of my earlier roles as a strategy consultant or as a leadership consultant, it's often been one of the key elements in building a relationship with somebody. So give us a sense of how that's played out in your stand-up in other aspects of your life.
You see, the problem is that nowadays people are trying to be perfect, right? With social media, every Facebook post is about how my life is amazing. It's all about, we have become a world where our sense of self-worth comes from external validation. Now, all human beings know that is not the case. People ask me about confidence. You know, yesterday I had a friend who asked me, how do you have the confidence to go up and talk like that? And I think the second you can understand that it is completely okay for you to fail, right? There's nothing wrong with failing. That is where confidence comes from. People ask me about presentations. I'm nervous about a presentation. The second you understand, it is completely okay for you to tell your audience, I don't know, but I can find out and come back to you. You're fine. Because what you might not realize is that all those other people have the same fears, the same vulnerabilities. And even if you fail, the fact is they will admire you for having the guts to put yourself out there and talk about things or do things that they didn't dare to do. At the end of the day, we're all human beings. We all have vulnerabilities. We all have pain. We all have weaknesses. The more human we can be with each other, the more that connection comes, right? I'm much happier opening up to you about my problems if I know that you have problems too, yeah. Right? But if you're this picture of perfection, then I'm like, whoa, maybe I don't want to hang out there and look bad. I mean, what do I do in Naked? In the show Naked, I put out all my weaknesses, all my pain. You will be amazed at the kind of stories people have told me afterwards. They have cried, they have opened up about various tragedies they have gone through in their lives, which they have suffered with for years. And many of them have walked out of the show thinking, you know what, if he can go through this and still find the positive, why can't I? You know, I think that's important for you to just, that's when you asked me right at the start, and my first answer was honesty. If you can be honest with yourself, and then take that honesty to other people. I think in today's day and age, that is a rare quality, and people will want to work with you or want to relate to you for that.
So CJ, talking about the parallels between the stand-up world and the business world, again, when I look at stand-up as a profession, clearly there's a piece around executive presence, holding your own in front of an audience. There's a piece around storytelling, which clearly has an impact on how you carry an organization with you. And there's a piece around humor, which is a good life skill, I believe. Give us a sense on how people can cultivate these skills and what are the clues from the stand-up world that can be applied in the business world.
So I would rather address the second part of your question, because the first part is pretty obvious. Presentation skills, gravitas. I help a lot of C-level executives with speech writing, because as comedians, we are mentally trained to cut out the fat. Every single extra word that is not required is removed. And we find a way to get to the punchline, whether it's a funny punchline or a business point that you're trying to make. But there is so much that business can learn from stand-up comedy. Today, as a performer, as Papa CJ, I'm a brand, right? It is a brand that I have to cultivate globally. Now, I deliver a service in, say, 20 different countries. My brand values, my point of view, my value proposition does not change no matter which country I'm in. My audience might disagree with me, but I'm not going to change what I stand for. Same with any brand. However, no matter which country I'm in, I have to get that audience to relate to me. Right? Yeah. Similar for a brand, how do you, in a world of 140 characters and limited attention span, how do you as a brand grab attention instantly? Comedy can teach you that. What do I do when I go to a new country? I find out about their history, their politics, their scandals. I read about the last 10 days' papers. And I start with information and material that they care about. Similarly with a brand, right? If you can talk about what concerns them instantly, you've got their attention. Then you can take them beyond their borders. Then you can bring them to your side and tell your story. But it's got to be about them first. So one, grabbing attention. Secondly, dealing with feedback. We get feedback every 15 seconds. As I've already said this, if they're not laughing, you got to change, yep. Right? How do you adapt instantly to feedback? Today, with social media, as brands, as organizations, you get feedback immediately. Now, for us, we deal differently. We don't have a standard response. Today, you see many of these companies, you'll send them a tweet, you get an Autobot, which will send you a standard response.
Yep.
We don't do that as comedians. You may have stock put down lines, but eventually that doesn't work. If a man heckles me, I have the freedom to destroy him instantly. If a woman heckles me, I have to be gentle until it gets to a point where she is disrupting the show for the rest of the audience. So for example, I had a very drunk woman heckling me once in the UK. My first heckle put down was, I said, oh, look, I'm being heckled by a woman with the most beautiful eyes I've ever seen. In fact, one eye is so beautiful, the other one can't stop looking at it, right? So funny, gentle put down. Then the next put down was, I got 400 people in the audience. I said, you want her to keep quiet? They was like, yes. On the count of three, I got 400 people in the audience to shout at one go to tell her to shut up. Next level, I said, ma'am, I would say something mean to you, but I'm not going to do that. I'm not allowed to do that because where I come from, cows are considered sacred. And eventually I went on to say, I'm sorry, ma'am, I don't know how to deal with you because where I come from, we don't have fat, drunk women with low self-esteem. Right? Now, that's an extremely rude thing to say. It's the kind of thing I would never say. But it's got to a point where the crowd hates her. They're entirely on my side. And her husband is practically after that covered her mouth and put her under the table. Now, the relationship to that is in your organization, when you're getting quote unquote heckled by customers, which customer do you put down? Which customer do you address? Who are you kind to? Right? And what are the different levels of the journey you have to take them down to deal with their query or their problem? When I go for a show and my mother or my father are there, my father is never watching me. He's watching the audience to see how they react, how I'm working the crowd. In your organization, who is CJ's dad? Who is Papa CJ's dad who is watching your audience? When my mom comes for a show, after every show, no matter how good it is, the first thing she will do is tell me about the things that I could have done better or that didn't work. I hate it. It drives me mad. But nothing teaches me more or helps me grow more than that feedback. In your organization, who is CJ's mom? So these are just some of the small elements that organizations can learn. I mean, today I've seen so many startups and their communication is terrible. They want how many ever millions of funding, but over 3 minutes they cannot even communicate what they do. I mean, come on, how difficult it is, right? What is your objective? I want funding. This is who I am. This is what we do. This is our team. This is the size of the opportunity for you. This is our success so far. Bang, done. That should take you 2 minutes with 2 points under each of those. They just can't seem to do it. They will pitch for 2 minutes and at the end of it, you're like, but what do you guys do? Right? So I think communication is a skill that comedians are very good at. And we can help turn 50 pages of presentation hogwash into 5 minutes of bulletproof stuff. That is something organizations can learn from us, cutting out the fat.
That's fascinating, actually. I'm told you need to write an hour's material to get 5 minutes worth or 10 minutes worth to make it bulletproof.
Yeah.
So I guess clearly there's something.
And
there.
Also what we do is we market test, right? I will take new stuff that I've written to 10 small shows, try it out, see what's worked, tweak it, before I take it on a big stage. That's another one of the things we do.
Yep. Just a couple of questions wrapping up, CJ. Again, it's an often used phrase. What are the three things that they don't teach you at B school? What would you say?
What are the three things they don't teach you at business school? They don't necessarily teach you empathy. A business school is it's normally an environment with a whole bunch of A-type people who are very driven. I don't think they teach you how to sit back and smell the roses, as they say. And I'm a very big advocate of the offline world. You know, nowadays everything is about online. It's Facebook and Twitter. And I believe in the art of conversation. I think it's beautiful to be able to just leave your phone behind, sit with somebody, have a cup of coffee and just talk. I'm going off track from business school, but I don't think it's all about getting to some destination really quickly. Sometimes it's nice to take a stroll and take your time to get there, because once you get there, then what? You know? So I think business school doesn't necessarily teach you to enjoy the journey. You know, one of the questions I always ask, especially young people who come to talk to me about careers or things like that, I ask them that if you had $1 billion in the bank, how would you spend your time differently? Not what would you spend the money on? And I think that's an important question to answer. Because, you know, often somebody will say, oh, I'll travel to Europe for a month. When you actually translate it down, what will that actually cost? Let's get to the specifics. Often I find that the cost of our dreams is much lower than we think it is in our heads. The problem is we all think, I'm going to work, I'm going to achieve, I'm going to do this, and then I will do this thing that I really want to do. Why? I mean, at the end of it, we're all going to be dead. You're not going to take anything with you. Why don't you just enjoy yourself while you're at it? Why does it have to be I'm going to reach there, then I'm going to do that? I mean, there are so many people who, when their lives are hit by some major tragedy, whether it's cancer, whether it's an accident, whether it's surviving one of those, you know, that changes their perspective and they look at the things that they really value in life. Why should you want to need to wait for something like that to happen to you before you can start appreciating what is important in the world? I think that is something that business school does not teach you.
True. That's quite profound. And some of these I've noticed in the long run as determinants of happiness and fulfillment, some of these hold a greater cue to some of those things, I would think.
Well, you know, they say that happiness is where three things meet: pleasure, challenge, and meaning. Often we run for pleasure. Challenge tends to get thrown our way one way or the other. But it's that search for meaning. So I think if you can find that meaning and build your pleasure and challenge around that, then you might find happiness.
That's an interesting frame. And on that note, as you know, this podcast is titled Play to Potential.
Yeah.
And this is about people listening to their inner voice.
Yeah.
And finding what they're meant to do, to use your language. So in summary, if I had to say for wrapping up, what are the one or two things you would like to leave behind for people to play to their potential?
The only thing I would say is turn your mobile phone off for 48 hours. Lock it away somewhere. You'll torture yourself. You'll feel like hell for the first 6 hours. But after that, you might find something that you haven't found in many, many years.
That's fascinating. And that's so profound on so many levels, given the technology-addicted world we live in. Thank you, CJ. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And to your point, I've enjoyed the offline conversation. It's been a wonderful experience. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in.